You're listening to Episode 8 of Season 7 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is the GNU World Order. My name is Klaatu. This show is, if you've not heard it before, this show is a technical ogcast. It's got a lot of technical information in it. May or may not be appropriate for people who aren't familiar with GNU Linux already, but I don't know, if you're just hungry for technical talks, stuff about GNU Linux, this might be a really good show for you to listen to, so welcome if this is the first time. If this isn't your first time listening and you're a long-time listener and all that other good stuff, well, you know the drill, so sit down and let's have some coffee and talk about GNU Linux. In this episode, we're going to be discussing listener feedback, which I'm, you know, 3-4 months behind in, so it's just kind of an obligatory, oh yeah, listener feedback kind of thing. As I say every time I catch up and do listener feedback, I might not be I am definitely not getting to all the listener feedback in this show, but I always, always, always reply, usually fairly verbosely, to emails that I receive at klaatu@member.fsf.org. So if you've emailed me and you've not gotten a response from me, then that is just a mistake. It was an oversight. It was something that I did not intend. So you can feel free to email me again and let me know, hey, you've never responded to this email. I thought this was interesting, or I had this issue, or whatever you want to say, really. So let's get started. I have a feeling, even though I'd love to get to other, you know, I've got a lot of stuff that I want to talk about, I have a feeling this episode's going to be a listener feedback episode, because there's always so much to say, because all of the listener feedback that I get is always so darned interesting. So let's begin. So first listener email is actually stolen from Hacker Public Radio, because someone emailed me at my own address rather than the Hacker Public Radio one, or maybe not, but anyway, it's in my inbox, so I'm going to discuss it. It's a guy named Alec, and he says that he really is appreciating the GNU Emacs episodes on Hacker Public Radio. So I will take this opportunity to advertise my own show on Hacker Public Radio, my mini-series on Emacs. If you were looking for a way to start Emacs, perhaps some tutorials, I've got about 3 episodes on there, Hacker Public Radio, about GNU Emacs, and it kind of, in my mind, it takes you through some of the more common and most useful features of Emacs, and kind of absolves you of having to learn anything too hard at first, because I feel like a lot of people are very, very, they're very hardcore about Emacs, and they're like, you have to learn it this way, or else you're not really using Emacs. And that's the way I used to try to learn it, and usually that is a great way for me to learn. I don't start light, usually. I don't start with Ubuntu and work my way up to something. I start with Slackware and work my way into Slackware. You know, it's not something that I do often. I like to dive in. That was not the case for Emacs for some reason. It just wasn't clicking until someone gave me permission, quote-unquote, to just use the GUI version of Emacs, use the menus, you know, use all the modern features of a modern graphical operating system. And once you know that so well, then it's trivial to switch over to the command line version or the terminal-based version. And so I highly recommend that. Robin from Norway emailed me a couple of times, actually, but I want to highlight maybe one or two particular email subjects. And one of them was Robin musing about why we all get excited about a new desktop, or we get grumpy about a new desktop, or whatever. We get a desktop, and we spend hours of our life making it look and act like our old desktop. Do you know what I mean? If, for instance, you decide, oh, I'm going to try a different desktop today. I'm going to try XFCE. I'm going to be crazy. So you download XFCE, you install it, and then you poke around for like 5 minutes, and then you realize, well, I really want the menu up here, and I want the I want Thunar to look different, and so I'll rearrange that, and I'll turn this feature off, and I'll turn this feature on, and I'll load up my little dock, and you know, you do all of this stuff to make it look like the other desktop, whatever it might be, that you're familiar with in the first place. And he's dead, he or she is dead on. You know, it's exactly correct. So, with exceptions, but I mean, if you think about it, you're probably thinking, yeah, that sounds familiar. Because I mean, even my KDE desktop doesn't look like everyone else's KDE desktop. It looks a lot like my old OS in many ways. At least I modeled it after that, and it acts a lot like Fluxbox. Again, at least I modeled it after that. With the way that I use Flux is the way that I use KDE and vice versa. So it is really interesting to think about that. I'm not sure what the bottom line point to that musing was. I know that I think it's an amusing insight or something amusing to notice. I think it rings true, but I feel like it's too trite, maybe. I don't mean that in a bad way, Robin, if you're listening. I just mean maybe it's too simplistic, because while there's truth to it, I also I've been thinking about it, and I think it also kind of feels like we spend a lot of time reinventing the desktop. You know, we have a base model. For me, it was my old OS. That was the desktop that I was used to, so that's kind of what I gravitate toward. But then my first desktop on Linux was, I think, literally it was Enlightenment, but Enlightenment was my first desktop on my old OS. I mean, my first X desktop on my old OS. On Linux, I believe the first one was actually Fluxbox, because that was what I'd heard about. I was installing Slackware. It asked me what desktop I wanted to default to, so I chose Fluxbox. So a lot of my sort of understanding of what a Linux desktop is supposed to be like is based on Fluxbox. That was the first one that I tried, and so that's kind of like, that's the ideal Linux desktop for me. So while I do, especially on KDE, which is all graphical and beautiful, and not minimal like Fluxbox, I tend to try to make it act like my old OS with all these new improvements that I've learned from Fluxbox and to a lesser degree OpenBox and GNOME 3, you know, just different, this whole mishmash of desktops that I've experienced, and I roll in the features that I like, and I modify the features that I don't like. I get rid of those, or I ignore them, or I turn them off, whatever. So I feel like Robin has a point, and I also feel like there's more to it than just that. Now, Robin emailed me again later. I don't remember if that was exactly the conversation we had. I hadn't thought about it as much when I first emailed Robin back, but at some point Robin emailed me back and said that Robin would be very interested in seeing how people use their desktops. So if you've got a desktop that you love, a desktop environment that you love, why do you love it? What about that desktop do you really, really like? What about that what about not having that desktop slows you down or makes you less efficient on some other desktop, aside from just not knowing where something is? You know, oh, they moved the logout button from the left to the right, whatever. What about the desktop really, really makes it your desktop environment? Why does it make you use that desktop, keep coming back to it? And the idea was to have screencasts just of your daily, everyday workflow. And I thought that was really, really a great idea. And it's something that I kind of even sat down and tried to do a couple of times, but I kept getting kind of sucked into one task. You know, I would sit down, I would start the screen recording, and then I would open Emacs, and I would never go back out to the desktop, which, to be fair, is, yes, that is a daily kind of routine for me. That is something that I do. However, there are moments during the day where I'm doing other stuff, and it's very much about the desktop and how it acts and some of those smaller features. So it's almost like you have to pre-plan a screencast and kind of list out all of the killer features that you love about your desktop that you really, really miss when you don't have it, and then screencast to highlight those things. One of those things for me, for instance, that I just kind of noticed recently was the move feature in KDE, how you can, you know, if you've got files on a thumb drive, let's say, that you've been collecting from different places and you want to copy them over to your desktop computer and you want to erase them off the thumb drive at the same time. You can do that in the terminal, obviously, but if you're doing this graphically, if you're kind of doing the graphical thing at that moment, then one of the nice things about KDE is that you can move those files, literally move them from the thumb drive to the desktop, rather than copying and then going back over to the thumb drive and deleting. It's a small thing. You'd think it's not really that big of a deal, and yet when you don't have it, like on GNOME 3 or some other operating system, it's like, I don't know, the moment you try to do it and it, you realize you don't have that feature, you're just like, oh my gosh, I can't believe how great my desktop is because it's got that feature and these other ones don't. So little things like that, you kind of have to highlight, I think. But the idea of screencasts of just kind of like, hey, here's how I use my desktop, that would be kind of neat. I like that idea. But I think it's a little bit more complex than it sounds because I've already derailed myself a couple of times when I was trying to do a screencast to demonstrate why the desktop works for me, you know, the desktops that I use, that why they work for me so well. I just end up not being able to express it, and I think I need to really kind of sit down and almost pre-plan it, script it out. I'm like, oh, I'll show this feature, and then I'll show that feature. But in order to script it out, you also have to sit down and really think about it. And that is something that I generally do, like, for Linux. You know, I sit down, and I think I even, on this show, I even listed, like, the 10 reasons I love Linux. You know, I mean, I think about those things, but I don't know that I've really gotten down to the point where I'm really, really thinking about the reasons that I just like KDE or Fluxbox more than, you know, some other desktop environment. Interesting stuff. Good ideas. I really like the way that Robin is thinking. Keep that up, Robin. Another listener, T. Kelly, talked about Sigil, S-I-G-I-L, and that is apparently an EPUB, I would say, generator from text files, HTML files, things like that. I think even PDF files. So T. Kelly tried out Sigil. I have not yet because I haven't gotten around to it. I mean, it sounds interesting, but I'm kind of doing my own EPUBs right now, so I haven't really felt like I should sit down and use Sigil yet, but I'm going to keep it in mind because it sounds like a quick and dirty and really nice way to grab, for instance, an article on a website and then convert it to EPUB really quick so that you can then put it on your device, your mobile device, and read it when you're not online. So it sounds like a great concept. I really like it. I've not tried it, but T. Kelly was kind enough to take an article from an online, from a website, converted it to EPUB, and then sent me the result. And it looked great. I mean, honestly, it looked really, really good. It wasn't beautiful. It wasn't, like, you know, all CSS'd out and really nicely laid out. But I mean, it was nicely laid out. It was basic looking, but it had all the information. T. Kelly wrote me again a little bit later and notified me of an issue, kind of a major issue, could result in possible data loss. And the workaround apparently is to not use autocorrect, which, again, I haven't tried Sigil, so I don't even know really what that refers to, but it's got something to do with a feature you can use autocorrect, and in some cases, I guess, there is data loss. I'm not sure where that data loss is. I don't know if that's just on the new EPUB file or if it's the source file, what's going on, but you have to be careful. The developer plans a fix for this in an upcoming version, so it should be fixed possibly by the time you hear this, because I'm recording this ahead of the time, and Sigil first told me about this on the 20th of December, so it's been a while now. But you can read about this issue at sigildev.blogspot.com if you need to know about the issue before you go trying Sigil. But it does sound like a great little project, and I'm happy to see quick ways to obtain EPUBs, because writing out everything in DocBook or taking the HTML files and then running it through an HTML2 DocBook script and then outputting the DocBook to the EPUB format, all that other stuff, that could get kind of old kind of quickly, I imagine. Sigflup wrote me, and this, again, isn't really feedback about GNU World Order, but it is sort of related to Hacker Public Radio. She says that first of all, so in Hacker Public Radio miniseries about packaging files, applications for your distribution, I cover Yum, ports, and Slack builds. I didn't mean Yum, of course, I mean RPM. RPM ports, Slack builds. And I, for the examples of each of those, I use Yes Please, because it's a simple application to package, in theory. And, it's just kind of easy to work with. So she emailed me an update about Yes Please, and the update is that Yes Please has an update. There's a new version out. I think it's it's December 2011, something around like 10 December 2011. And it also has an encryption library now that it can use so that it can encrypt the configuration file, which is really, really cool. Very mysterious. I have no clue about any of that stuff, so it's really neat that she's implementing that. Anytime I hear encryption, of course, I feel pretty good about it. And, you know, I kind of wonder even if it wouldn't be something that people might want to kind of use for other things, because, I mean, I can only think of one right now, and that is, I'm sorry, two, I think. Two right now. That's Fetchmail and MSMTP. Both of those have, it's both of those too. And I think there might be others that I'm just not thinking of right now, but both of those have config files that you're supposed to place in your home directory, and kind of the best protection they have on guarding the password is just chmod it so that only you can read it. That just seems, I mean, that's a plain text password right in your home directory. That just doesn't feel right to me. And so if they had something just like this little encryption library, I mean, that it seems to me like that would be something. Again, I don't know anything about this stuff, so I could be, I mean, maybe it just wouldn't matter. I don't know. But it is kind of cool that she's working on that. She's working in that direction. It's really, really neat. So check out the new Yes Please. You have to update to the new Yes Please because you can't access Unix puppies or Unix porn with the old Yes Please because, unless you do some changing in the source code, which you can because it's free software, but the location of the photo albums, the screenshot albums was hard-coded in the source code. So the old version, if you're using the old version, you've got to change the source code and then recompile so that is something that you can then access. The new version, of course, has that change. It works beautifully. It works fine. So check that out if you want. I have Slack builds of it built on GNUWorldOrder.info/slackware/both yes please and I think the I'm not remembering the name of the little encryption library off the top of my head, but they're in the Slackware folder on GNUWorldOrder.info. Got an interesting one from a guy named Craig. I'm not going to say his last name to protect his identity, but Craig wrote me about actually just the previous episode in my mind, although it's actually I think two episodes ago to you as the listenership. But it was something that Holstein on the audio workflow episode was talking about, and that is an impulse response reverb effects unit. Impulse response, in case you don't know, and I don't know the exact technology behind it, but this is what I do know about it. I could be describing it very simplistically or maybe even a little bit wrong. The idea is that some audio technicians go out to different locations. For instance, a big cathedral. And they'll place a microphone or something that is like a microphone, maybe, that gets the same signals as a microphone would. And they place it at some place in the cathedral, and they make a noise. A couple of different noises, maybe. And those noises, or that noise, reverberates off of the cathedral walls and eventually comes back to that microphone that they have placed inside the cathedral. They don't get the sound, but they get the characteristics of the sound. They get the way that sound is bouncing off those walls, with what magnitude and how that kind of feels to that microphone or that pickup. And then they use that data to create a reverb effect, so that you, when you apply this reverb effect to your sound, now the sound behaves virtually exactly as that other sound did in that particular cathedral. So every subtlety, every little nook and cranny that the sound could possibly bounce off of, and the delay from, you know, of the treble versus the bass, or whatever that characteristic I guess in a big cathedral, the bass would probably reach that microphone first. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's what I understand. So, you know, you'd get that kind of characteristic of that sound. And then they can also go out and they can take that microphone to a cave and they can make a sound in the cave. And depending on what kind of cave it is and what kind of rock formations are around, you know, you'll get a different kind of reverb. And actually, I've been in a cave like once and it was actually not very reverbery at all. It was actually completely dead. It was really flat sound, interestingly. But you get the idea. You can literally take this magic microphone with a magical audio technician who knows what they're doing and go to any environment. It can be a mountaintop, it can be a cave, it can be a cathedral, it could be a house, it could be a theater, it could be whatever you can think of. They'll measure the way that the sound reacts in that environment, and then they use those responses to create reverberation, impulse response reverb effects. So it's a really cool technology. It typically sounds really, really nice because you're getting that kind of action from your sound. You're not just emulating it, and you're not just, I mean, if you look at a reverb unit, like a basic reverb unit, you've got maybe 5 different controls. You know, you can set how long your reverb lasts. You can determine how quickly it decays, how much reverb there is to the raw sound or the dry sound, how many wet or dry sound you get, how loud the reverberation is in relation to the sound, the initial sound, and things like that. So you've got a couple of controls, and it's good in a, well, oh yeah, and the size of the room usually. I mean, so that kind of controls usually how long it takes for that sound to bounce back. So it works, and you can fake a lot of different effects. You know, if you make it a small room, then it sounds like you're in a small little space and sound is bouncing right back off the walls. And then you could even make it not bounce too much. So maybe it's not a solid tile room. You know, it's got some carpet in there or some things to kind of deaden the sound. So you can fake it, but when you get an impulse response reverb unit, it's really, really amazing. You can do wonderful, wonderful things. So Holstein had mentioned this. I got excited about it. I think I put a link in the show note, but I'll put another link in this show note because it's at factorial.hu/plugins/LV2/IR. So LV2, if you don't know, is the LADSPA version 2. LADSPA, if you don't know, are the kind of de facto effect plugins for a lot of the Linux audio stuff. I mean, I've used it on other platforms as well because they do work there, but they're really kind of the big ones in Linux audio. The ubiquitous ones are Steve Harris's set of plugins. So the LADSPA is really good stuff. LV2 is supposed to be the next generation of that. It's supposed to be really cool, really hot. I don't actually use that many LV2 plugins yet, but this is one I'm going to check out. factorial.hu/plugins/LV2/IR. Works great, he says, in Ardour, probably in QTractor, although he said some early version of QTractor was having problems with it, but that was a while ago, so it's probably been fixed by now. And in fact, I think I saw in the changelog of a fairly recent QTractor that some LV2 improvements had been made, so that might be exactly what he's talking about. He says that the actual IR, you know, the actual impulse response files, you know, with that data, with that bounce back data, that kind of thing, or the presets, I guess you would just think of them as, you know, a preset to load into this impulse response unit. Those are a little bit harder to find because they're not necessarily just floating out there on the internet for, you know, free as in legally free. He says that it would be a great idea possibly to have, as part of the next multimedia sprint, to grab a bunch of IR files, which, honestly, yeah, I think that's a great idea. That sounds fantastic. I really kind of need to follow through with the next multimedia sprint because I keep saying it's going to happen and I keep putting it off, but there you go. That is some great information. Craig says that, at the moment, Craig is working with Fedora 14 and the Karma repos. So the Karma Repos, that's what they call them. They're CCRMA. That's Center for Computer Research in Music and Acoustics. It's over at Stanford University, and they apparently are using Fedora or something for music studies over there, which is really, really cool. But even cooler is that they package up a lot of music applications into RPMs, and they post them online for everyone. I actually steal a couple of things from them just every now and again. Like, if there's a package that I just can't find a Slack build for and I don't want to be bothered, I'll look at Planet Karma, I mean, music applications, obviously, or multimedia, really. I think I've found a couple of non-strictly musical applications, but it's all multimedia for sure. I'll go over there and see if they have an RPM for it, and then I'll just use RPM to TGZ on Slackware, convert it to a Slackware package, and then install it from there. So it's a great resource if you're running either Slackware or Fedora, or maybe, I don't know, maybe Debian if you can do the alien thing. It's a good resource. So check Planet Karma out, and the website for that is ccrma.stanford.edu. So thanks for the email, Craig. And now before I get into the next set of listener feedbacks, I should probably go get a cup of coffee. And you know what? So should you.
Space Coffee, the choice of United Planetary Space Cadets all over the galaxy.
And now for the annual Ron deluge of emails. So Ron, or Macro Ron, is a listener who sends me just a whole bunch of stuff. It's like link after link after link, to such an extent that sometimes I can't even handle them all. But that shouldn't be misinterpreted to mean that I don't appreciate it, because I do. They're really interesting topics. Lately, Ron has been doing a lot with command line email stuff, trying to figure out the whole fetch mail, proc mail, send mail / MSMTP, and just all that stuff. I was trying to help him over email set up his email. That's kind of a funny thing to do. But yes, I was trying to help a little bit. I think he made progress, and I think in the end he learned a lot about that stuff, which is really cool. And frankly, so did I, because email is really complex. I don't think there's any way around that. I think that at the end of the day, it's a very complex thing to handle. And it, like, on the surface, it doesn't seem like it should be so complex. But then when you think about what we demand of email, it actually is, it can be really, really, really insanely difficult. And I guess the issue has become even more complex, because now we really need middlemen server because of the spam issue, which to me is it's a real pity. And I keep thinking that the whole spam issue could have been a little, I don't know, if it seems like it could have all been handled differently. I'm not exactly sure what that different method would be, but it has something to do with whitelisting senders of email, and just not accepting everything that you possibly can. I don't know. Somehow it seems like there was a ball dropped somewhere in there. Like, not because any, I mean, I don't think it's because anyone was not doing their job or anything. Of course, I'm speaking as if those just three guys who are sitting around handling email. I mean, it's the whole world trying to figure that stuff out. But it feels like, before people realized that spam was going to be such an issue, I think, you know, people kind of developed a way of handling email and doing email, and then spam became a huge issue, and now we're all having to fight it off and stuff like that. So it feels like that there could be some other way around that. But I think right now, at this point, it's just kind of, it's completely out of control. Maybe it was inevitable. I don't know. Anyway, we learned a lot, but there's SMTP servers now to really make sure that people aren't just being relays for spam. And so email is a complex issue. And his emails that I'm about to discuss have nothing to do with any of that, because I did do an email episode back in season 5, I think it was. I think it might have been 502 or 507 or 517, something like that. So there's information on that if you're looking to set up your email system. And I think the most basic summary of what Ron and I kind of went back and forth with is that, number one, there are two emails that we think about when we're talking about, okay, I want to set up, you know, my email on my system as a command line tool that I want to use. There are actually two things that we're talking about, and that can get confusing, so pay attention. So one system that we frequently talk about, I think, is the email system built into our computer. And that's the kind of thing where you're getting emails from little system, you know, like your cron job and stuff like that. It's just emailing you at your local host, letting you know, hey, someone tried to use sudo and got rejected. I thought you should know about it. Or, hey, this cron job didn't run. So I'm emailing you to let you know that there was a failure for some reason. That kind of email, that builds up in your email spool. And that's basically an email server just kind of built into your computer, just kind of running on, and just, it's there and it exists. And that really confused me, because I thought that was what I was supposed to tap into when doing the email thing on my computer in the command line. Turns out that's not really necessarily at all the truth. You don't have to utilize that in any way. What you do need, as I've said in the episode previously, is a way to reach out and get the email from a server out there in the world. Because nowadays we don't get email delivered directly to our computer, correct? You're not sitting on your desktop with a static IP with your email port open, and people aren't sending it straight to your IP address. They're not sending it to clat2@71.123.8.18. We're not receiving it that way. They're sending it to hackerpublicradio.org, or they're sending it to member.fsf.org. So what I need to do while I'm on my desktop or my laptop or whatever is reach out there and grab that email message or those messages from that external server. And the thing that we use for that is, well, the thing that I use for that is Fetchmail. Fetchmail is old. It is, I think, maybe not maintained anymore. I don't really remember the details on that, but it exists. It works. It will log into an account out there on a server. It will fetch your email and copy it over to your computer system. Now, I kept thinking that I had to integrate Fetchmail with the mail spool on the computer. Wrong. You don't have to do that. That's not the same email. That's your computer's little built-in email is one thing. You can separate yourself from that. You don't have to have your Fetchmail talk at all to your email spool. You can have Fetchmail, and this is what I do now, just dump it into a folder in your home directory, which is what I do. So I have a /mail, and I have Fetchmail copy the messages from the server to my /mail. Before it gets dumped into /mail, it gets processed through procmail. And procmail is just a mail processor. It looks at all the email that I've just grabbed from that external server. It looks for keywords, and I can define these keywords with recipes, is what they're called in procmail. So you can say, okay, if anything has KDE-promo in it, well, then it's a KDE promo list email, so let's move it over into this folder. Or if it's got Fedora art, then let's put it in this folder. Or if it's got Blender commits, put it over in this folder. You know, there's all these different things that we each get, and procmail can sort that for us. Very nice. After procmail, then I've got messages in folders, or I've got messages in my /mail, however I've configured procmail. And for the record, my procmail is very, very basic. I don't have a lot of filtering going on, but I could if I wanted to look into how, you know, fancier recipes. So once I've got the /mail, then I've got the data. I got plain text sitting in my /mail. I can do whatever I want to. If I'm really old school or low tech or whatever, or I just really like Misery, I could just do a less on that file, and that would give me every message back to back with all the ugly headers that I could ever want to look at, which actually are really useful to look at a lot of times. But, you know, I mean, you just see them, and you can do that. You can, if you have SSH access to your mail server out there online, you can SSH into it, and you can find your mail file, and you can do a less on it, and you can look at it, and it'll just be a bunch of email messages back to back. Now, more realistically, what you're probably going to want to do is have some application kind of manage that for you and kind of parse it for you. And that's what Mutt, for instance, is. Mutt simply directs itself into /mail. It looks there. It finds the mail file. It looks at that mail file. And where it says a header that says 2:, then it knows that that's the beginning of one message. And then it keeps reading down the text file, and then it hits the next 2, so that must be a new message. So then it takes the subject line and places it in the second column, and it takes the third column really, it takes the subject after the from line, puts it into the second column, and numbers the first column, and so on. And so you've got this nice little list of all the email messages that you want to look at and then respond to. And then, of course, you can set up an external editor of some sort. I use, lately I've been using Jed just for fun. But you just say, okay, I'm going to reply, and then it copies the text of that message from that file into an empty document in Jed, in an empty, or whatever, Emacs, Nano, whatever, Vim. And you've got a blank document with the text of that email, and you can respond, and then you can save it, and then send it all through Mutt. Now, Mutt can, as I've recently learned from Link on the Linux Link and Tech Show, it can actually send straight to an SMTP server now. I don't know. Maybe it's always been there and I just didn't know about it. I use MSMTP because that's what I knew when I was first setting up my little system. But you could also just define in the Mutt RC file what SMTP user to use. And then when you hit send, basically the reverse of what we've just done is happening. It takes that text message, that text file, and it sends it up to a mail server. And this is your SMTP server, so it's your outgoing server. So you've got some way to log into it, whether it's a certificate or a username and a password. However it works for your ISP or your mail provider, it could be Gmail, it could be your ISP, it could be your work, it could be anything, it could be your web host. It's going to recognize your login information given by the SMTP program, whatever you're using. It's going to log you in. It's going to accept the text file, and then it's going to route it to the correct domain as specified in your 2 subject or your 2 line. And that's it. That's all email is. When I say it like that, it just seems so simple, doesn't it? It's not really that complex, and yet it's so complex. But honestly, really, I think there are 2 things that are complex about it. Number one, first and foremost, at least for me, on the command line, you know, you go to a command line and you type in mail and you hit enter and you see potentially mail or you have no mail, whatever. That's your mail spool on the computer. Do not confuse that for the email that you're trying to check out on the internet. Not that they can't be the same thing or merged or kind of combined in some way. I don't know that it would behoove you to do it that way. But they are 2 separate systems. You don't have to actually try to integrate your mail spool in the computer with the mail spool out in the real internet world. That's issue number 1. Issue number 2 is knowing how to log into the server that has your stuff. And that would be, what does fetch mail need to know to get into your mail server? And that's unusually difficult, right? You'd think, well, that would be so easy. I'll just give my username and my password. Well, what if your username is actually your username and the @ symbol and the domain name, and the password is, well, probably just your password. But, and you have to know what protocol it supports. Does it, you know, can you get it through POP, or do you have to investigate IMAP? Like, what can you do? And you wouldn't be using FetchMail for IMAP, but I mean, what do you do? So, that's the confusion. And then the same thing for SMTP, you know, how do you get it? How do you log into that server so that it accepts your message and then sends it on? Those are the 2 sort of big issues, just like differentiating between the mail that you're actually trying to set up in your command line and how to log into the servers out in the real world. Solve those two issues, or get past the first one and then solve the second one, I think you'll be fine. And now on to the actual email that Ron sent me. Actually, the discussion about the email was more probably was a bigger topic than the actual email he sent. But one of the messages that he sent me most recently was some stuff about Grub 2. I don't use Grub really all that much. I mean, I do on a Fedora system, I guess, but I don't really think about it. I'm running Slackware. I tend to just kind of settle for Lilo. I don't really see the advantage to Grub in my current workflow. I'm not saying don't email me, like, yelling at me. I know Grub 2 is cool. I don't deny that Grub is cool. I'm just saying that for what I do, which is I turn the computer on or I wake it up more often than not, I don't find that I really need Grub that much. But I respect it. And Grub 2 sounds really cool, and I keep meaning to start playing around with it because it sounds like it can do amazing things. I just haven't yet. But he emailed me, Ron did, and said that there were a bunch of .mod files in his Grub 2 folder. Couldn't figure out why. Furthermore, his system was interpreting the .mod extension as an Amiga MIDI file or something like that, Amiga sound file, something like that. So he ended up asking on a forum or something. I think it was possibly askfedoraproject.org, and if it wasn't that one, then that's something that he did tell me about, ask.fedoraproject.org. It's a really cool Fedora help site that you might want to check out. But he asked about it and got an answer, and it turns out that Grub 2 has modules that it can load, and so the .mod files in Grub 2 are different modules that Grub 2 can take advantage of to do really cool things. So that's if you're seeing weird mod files in your Grub 2 folder, and you're wondering what they are, that is what they are. Also, he told me about the ask.fedoraproject.org, which I think is a significant tip. I think that's kind of good to know about. Another tip-off he sent me was that Slax is sort of back for a new version, up and coming. It's not out yet, but apparently they'll be rolling out a new Slax fairly soon here. Slax 7, I believe, will be the release number. Slax, if you don't know, and I'm sure you do, it's a really cool thumb drive or CD-based distribution. They've got this really cool idea of little loadable modules that you can do. I used to be kind of more into it than I am now, mainly because they came out with so many modules that every time I would try to build one, I'd get carried away and put too many modules in there. But it is a really interesting system. It's very inventive and very original way to attack that kind of issue of how do you make a minimal distribution with a lot of customization opportunities. So it's cool. Check it out if you haven't lately, slax.org. But I guess technically you should wait till Slax 7, since apparently it's sort of kind of on its way. So that's Ron. Thank you again for all your emails, Ron. Very, very interesting stuff. And Rex, I keep forgetting how to say his last name. Rex DeGier, from the LibreCast now. I think it used to be, well, I don't think it used to be. It sort of used to be the AcrossAd podcast. So now he's doing LibreCast. It's an Ogcast. One of his recent ideas was to have a central site where you could go to find all of the projects and causes, I guess, that relate to free software that you could donate to. So if you go to DeGere.com, that's DeGere.com/donate, then you can go to the page, and he's got links from there directly to the projects. So essentially, if you're looking for something to donate to, or if you love a project and you don't know where their donate location is, then you could go to DeGere.com/donate. Ostensibly, you could find it, that project, and then you could click on their link. It will take you to their project donate page, and then you can donate. So it's basically it's a good bouncing off point or an index page of all the different donation pages, which I think is great, because I honestly do believe that more people would donate to projects if they could simply find out how to donate. And I think it's not done all that well all that often. Now, sometimes it is. It's done really well on some sites, but I mean, on others, it just feels a little bit like I have to go deep into your site to find your donate thing, and then I have to go through a bunch of steps to be able to donate to you. It's really, really nice when it's just a button and you click it and it takes you to the checkout thing and you put in the amount that you're going to donate and you're done, you're finished, you're over. I don't much care personally, and this is just a personal feeling, that sort of intercepting me before I download kind of feel, like, oh, I'm going to click on this download button and then they're going to take me to a plea for the donation. And kind of like, I don't know, it feels like they're trying to guilt trip me into it or something. I mean, I understand the psychology of it. I just don't like it, I guess. But I would love to just be able to go to a page of my favorite software and there's a little donate button right under there, the title of the page or something. And you click that and you can send some money their way and then download the project or the software that you need or whatever. And then you're off and running and you feel good about yourself. They feel good because they got money and everyone's happy. So I think that making it easy to donate to the projects that you want to support is a good thing. And as I think we said on the fairly recent Hacker Public Radio 12-hour marathon right before the new year, it isn't that I think, by any means, that everyone should donate to software that they use, because, I mean, it is free software, and it should be accessible to everyone in spite of your financial ability to, whether you could actually afford it or not. That's, I think, one of the key things about free software, because, yes, you can illegally obtain other software titles that are not GNU brand free software. But it is illegal, and if the companies could, ostensibly they would sue you or whatever. So getting it and saying that it's okay for you to get it for free and no one's going to come after you and no one resents you for it, that's a good thing and is important. And it kind of shows that the ideals are in the right place. You know, we don't want people to be hindered in learning or being creative or being productive or whatever just because they can't make some magical price point. And we don't want them to waste their time trying to torrent an application that probably isn't even worth the time spent trying to torrent the thing and getting the cracked serial code and stuff. It's just get the thing, get it on your computer, start learning it, and off you go. Very important. But at the same time, if you want to donate and if you have the money and you want to support a project, then you should be able to do that. Again, not with a whole lot of effort, because it is to some degree the impulse buy kind of mentality too. You don't want people to say, you know, they wake up in the morning and they say, man, I'm using that KDE so much, I'm going to join the game, I'm going to give them money and join up with KDE. And so they jump online and they can't find a button, and 30 minutes later the buzz is kind of gone. They don't really want to do it anymore, so they fail, they quit. So you want to make it accessible. Looks like dejir.com/donate is doing that for you. Go check it out, won't you? Thank you. Okay, I think that's more or less all the direct emails that I can go through right now, simply because we're kind of running out of time. But like I say, everyone who didn't get mentioned right now got an email back, so we're good, right? We're all cool? Okay. So let's go through some of the little tips that I've stolen from my time in IRC. IRC is a great little meeting place, by the way. If you're not on freenode.net, check it out. You know, I mean, learn an IRC application. They're pretty prevalent. It's a little bit of a learning curve, but, or at least it was for me. Some of you have been doing it since 1983, but for me it was a big deal. And it's really cool, and you learn a lot of stuff, and you also waste a lot of time, but you make friends, so it evens out. The IP address issue. Everyone has some moment where they need to find their actual real-world IP address. Turns out you can do a curl, C-U-R-L, space, ICANHAS IP.com. That is ICANHAS, H-A-Z, IP.com. If you do that, you will get your IP address, your real-world, outside, public-facing IP address on the command line faster than you can blink. It's a beautiful command. The other way, of course, would be to go to like duckduckgo.com and just type in, what is my IP? And it will actually tell you as well, so that's kind of nice. There used to be like whatsmyip.org or something, but that's gone. And now there's a, I think, whatismyip.com. But honestly, the curl ICANN has IP.com. It's just so quick, so easy, really, really nice. Actually, I think that's it for my IRC lessons. Remember how I said you learn a lot? I meant you learn like one thing. But yeah, it's good information to have. So remember that curl ICANN has IP.com. I think we've reached the end of the show for today. So thank you very much for listening. You can always reach me in IRC. My nick is NotClaw2. You can reach me over the Jabber network, so instant messaging and stuff like that. My nick is NotClaw2 at jabber.org. You can email me at claw2@member.fsf.org. You can find me in online, on the internet, no less, at gnuworldorder.info. Thanks for listening, and I will see you next time.
I need some first-hand research. I want to get the atmosphere. Find out how widespread witchcraft really was, what the witches were really like.